From the Truman Presidential Library and Museum in Independence, Missouri, KPR presents A Nation Engaged. I'm Kay McIntyre. As Donald Trump marked the 100th day of his presidency, NPR asks, just how powerful should the president be? How powerful should any American president be? NPR and public radio stations across the country are taking part in a collaborative project, A Nation Engaged, Power and the Presidency. As part of A Nation Engaged, about 100 Kansas Cityans gathered at the Truman Presidential Library and Museum on Tuesday, April 25th, 2017, to weigh in on the power of the presidency and how President Trump fits or defies presidential tradition. This event was sponsored by NPR and our affiliate station, KCUR, and was moderated by NPR's John Burnett and KCUR's Steve Kratzky. They were joined by Randy Soule, archivist at the Truman Presidential Library, and Max Skidmore, professor of political science at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This event kicked off with Dr. Skidmore providing some historical context on the powers that the U.S. Constitution grants to the president.
The Constitution in Article 2 sets out the powers of the president, and he may require in writing the opinions of each of the heads of the executive agencies, cabinet officers, and he has the power to negotiate treaties subject to ratification by two-thirds of the Senate. He can nominate officers of the government subject to confirmation by the Senate. And from time to time, he shall, may and shall, and it turns out to be annually, report on the State of the Union to the Congress. And as a part of that authorization, he is empowered to suggest items to Congress. He can't technically introduce a bill. Only a representative can introduce a bill in the House or a senator in the Senate. But he can suggest subjects for legislation to Congress. He is Commander-in-Chief of the military. He may receive ambassadors. And now that could be interpreted as being just a ceremonial power, but it's been interpreted as far more than that. Very important, he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So that makes him the chief law enforcement officer of the United States government. And he commissions officers of the United States down to and including ensigns and second lieutenants in the military. In the legislative article, Article 1, there is also one more power. Although the word isn't used, it spells out the procedure for vetoing bills. The president has the power to sign bills, to refuse to sign them, return them to the originating house for possible override.
How is President Trump within the tradition of the American presidency? To frame it a little better, how is he outside the tradition of the American presidency, and how is he acting like past presidents or not acting like past presidents? So let me ask the Truman archivist, Randy Soule. In these parts, it's fair to say that Give 'Em Hell Harry was a very popular figure. How did the public judge him when he first came into office? Did they find him presidential in 1945? He'd been vice president for fewer than 90 days. He had to become a commander-in-chief and end a world war.
I don't think he was seen as presidential by most Americans. He was seen as kind of the little man. Most Americans didn't know much about him. Roosevelt had been president for 12 years. It was hard for a lot of Americans to envision anyone else as president. And Truman was very different from Roosevelt. He came from the Midwest. He came from a humble background. He had not gone to Harvard. He had not gone to any college or university. He was had been a farmer and a small businessman. And so, yeah, he seemed to be not what people had thought of as a president. But I think some of the virtues of that background, the honesty, the simplicity, the humility of the man in the long run helped him and helped him win over the American public. But the first reaction was, I think the shock of Roosevelt's death was so great, Truman was kind of an afterthought, and some people genuinely afraid that this fellow was going to be president.
Right. So, unlike Truman, we have our current president who's had no military experience, no public office experience, brand new in the presidency. I'd like to invite Gail Brecke to the microphone to give us her view. Gail, how do you view President Trump within the tradition of the American presidency?
I would agree with what you just said in terms of he is not the traditional president in terms of having been a politician, a career politician perhaps. He, I think, most obviously is a businessman. He is not first and foremost a politician. So I think to many of us, he appears to be very different. He behaves differently than presidents that we've seen in the past because of that. So I think he seems to be interested in behaving as a businessman would in terms of getting things done and fixing things, and not so much necessarily interested in the politics of the House and Senate and legislation and what the typical process has been. So I think he does appear to me to be different than past presidents in that way.
Do you think that's a strength or a liability?
Perhaps a little of both. I think, you know, his way of getting things done and just, you know, sticking with his agenda and just being very proactive and trying to get things fixed and get movement on things could be a good thing, particularly if you like what he's doing. I think it can be a little bit challenging at times to feel like you're kind of with him and understand what he's doing and why. So I think it's a mixed bag.
Okay. Jury's out. Max, do you want to talk about other presidents who were considered outside the tradition of the office in their times?
The only ones I can think of who in any way were sufficiently outside that he could be considered, that they could be considered at all, like Mr. Trump, would be, first of all, Andrew Jackson. He was the first person to assume the presidency who had not been part of the governing elite, the governing group, the national gentry, as someone had.
He was completely outside the box.
Completely,
right?
Outside the box. He was nominated by the state legislature of Tennessee, not by the congressional caucus that had always nominated everyone else. He was the first president to be catapulted to the office by popular acclaim. In the early years, they didn't even have popular vote in most states. And state legislatures chose the presidential electors. But Andrew Jackson was a popular hero dating all the way back to 1815 and the Battle of New Orleans that wound up the, he thought, wound up the War of 1812 that unknown to him was already over, and unknown to the British was already over, but the television reception was very poor in those days.
Well, but, is he the president who was as far outside the box, Max, as any president until President Trump?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yes.
And did you hear that?
I would say as a runner-up would be Abraham Lincoln. At least in the South, he was viewed as someone who was completely off base, completely out of the mainstream and so forth. Turns out that he, by almost all measures, has turned out to be the best of all people who have occupied the presidency. You don't expect someone with a relatively limited background, but he was self-educated and autodidact. Well, wasn't really an autodidact. He was very deeply educated in Shakespeare and the Bible and the law, but not very broadly educated. But he thought very, very soundly, and he had the character for the presidency.
Okay. We have someone who's going to break the ice for us. Bless you. What's on your mind?
My name is Linda Neal. I'm a sole practitioner attorney at law. And if you stop to read some of the letters that Harry Truman wrote to Bess, 3 or 4 months into his presidency, they're very revealing. In one sentence, he says, as soon as I can get State Department straightened out, I'll come home and be with you. And then he says, oh, by the way, I also have to straighten out Navy and the Army. And then further along in the letter, he indicates that once he just can tell these people what he wants them to do, everything will be just like he was administrating in Jackson County. So, I think maybe we have to consider President Truman as very much out of the box of tradition, at least in the first 3 to 6 months, maybe until December of 45, as out of the box of the traditional type of process president.
If I could interject here, one difference
Max,
is that Harry Truman, Abraham Lincoln, and Andrew Jackson all had keen political instincts and all were thoroughly versed in the political system. Mr. Trump, all presidents to some extent learn on the job. But Mr. Trump clearly is learning on the job, and he has far more to learn than his predecessors.
Okay. We have a really great question on Twitter here. Randy, what do you think about this? Are Trump's tweets, like FDR's fireside chats, should they be archived as part of the National Archives?
I believe they probably will be.
They will be?
Yeah. You think they should be?
Yes. I think Mr. Truman believed very strongly, and I tend to agree with him, that everything a president writes and says, anything that he records that relates to his term of office or his responsibilities as president should be preserved. And so I would have to say yes.
Okay. Ma'am, if you would, tell us your name and what you do.
My name is Toni Vienz, and I am a real estate consultant. I basically work with property owners on office buildings and hotels to get their values reduced if the values are overassessed by the taxing agency. I'm a good Italian girl, first generation Italian, brought up in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. So after graduate school, I went back to New York City. I went to the University of Florida for my graduate and undergraduate studies. And back then, when I graduated, women were made a lot more money in New York City than they made in Tampa, Florida. In fact, at that point, I didn't even know what express elevators were. I ended up being Vice President Chief Appraiser of National Westminster Bank. In the property valuation, I attended a number of Mr. Trump's meetings and had lunch with Larry Silverstein and his wife regarding the World Trade Centers. Trump is really very much a New Yorker, and a lot of his bombastic attitude and way of doing things is not that he's trying to be crude or rude or offend people. That's the way many New Yorkers are. And that's it. And I could tell you some jokes, but I'm going to sit down.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Trump is certainly non-traditional, and I think that's a good thing. If you look at what's happened in Washington in the last 50, 60 years, where we've constantly passed new laws, where we've constantly run up deficits, and especially the last 8 years, something has to change. We as taxpayers and citizens out here in flyover country, we need to have a voice, and we need to hold Washington responsible. And I spent 90 days in Washington in 1976, and they asked me to stay, but I didn't because it was out of control then, and it's gotten much worse. So I hope Trump accomplishes a third of the things he set out to do. He has a lot of people against him doing many of the things that he's brought up, but hopefully he will.
So 100 days in, how much difference do you think he's going to wind up making?
Well, as I said, if he can accomplish a third of the goals that he set out that got him elected, I'll be a happy camper. Because, he's a third of the government, he has a third of the powers, and, he has to deal with the Senate, he has to deal with the Supreme Court, and all those people have their say, as that's how the Constitution was put together. So, how much can he accomplish? If he accomplishes a third, I'm a happy camper.
What's the most important thing for you that you hope he accomplishes?
How many hours can I speak? There are so many things that I think, like I say, are out of control. We have overtaxation, we have overregulation, we have overspending, and those are the three, I think, most important things that need to be considered and need to be adjusted to get us back on a fiscally responsible and legally responsible, follow the laws, enforce the laws that are on the books. If you don't like the laws on the books, Congress needs to change them, and the Supreme Court rules on the change.
So a lot of things you want to see him do.
He campaigned on probably 30 or 40 major subjects. If he accomplishes a third of them, I'm happy.
Okay. Thank you very much. I want to ask you something
sure.
also.
Yeah.
As a representative of the enemy of the people here, we both are, which Mr. Trump called the press, I'd like to know, how do you think the press is handling Donald Trump? He thinks I don't cover the presidency, but my colleagues do.
Overall, I think he is correct in saying that the Fourth Estate has gotten out of control. I think the Fourth Estate is now a proponent of whoever they think meets their ideological goals, precepts, whatever. And so the press needs to be challenged. I'll challenge you. That doesn't bother me at all. But I write to the Star from time to time, and occasionally even publish a letter that I write. But the press has become so politicized both ways. I mean, it's not all on one side, certainly. That I don't think that the press is supposed to determine the facts, report the facts, and let me, you know, or give me the credit to have enough brains to make up my mind as to what this person is saying and doing, is it good or bad? The press is not, in my opinion, to dictate to me what I should think and how I should act.
Well, you certainly described John. You haven't described me very well. But we appreciate your comments.
I see your articles in the Star. Pretty regularly.
We'll talk afterwards. Yes. Sir, yes. Welcome.
My name is Tom Handley. I'm a retired actuary, and I dealt with healthcare for over 40 years. You know, Donald Trump ran a very non-traditional campaign, and so I think we all expected him to be a very non-traditional president. But I think one of the things that we need to be, I think we're all aware of, we don't quite know how to deal with, is the uncertainty. He is, because he wasn't very predictable, we don't know what he's going to be like as a president. And I think that's going to cause a lot of concerns. In the first 100 days, you know, the stock market, businesses, they haven't really had time to react. They're kind of sitting back, okay, what is this guy going to do? And obviously, he's a CEO of a corporation. I think all of the boards that he's had to deal with are people that he appointed. And so now he has to deal with a board. He has to deal with Congress. And so it's going to be very difficult for him to accomplish, I think, some of the things he would like to accomplish. He is going to have to adjust the way he operates. He can't be a CEO. And I think the uncertainty certainly is being played out a little bit in foreign policy. And I think it's going to be, I think by December, we're going to see what the stock market thinks of him.
Well, Tom, how do you feel about this uncertainty you're talking about, you personally?
I dealt with uncertainty for over 40 years. You know, I had to predict people's behavior, you know, were they going to go to the doctor, how many prescriptions, and so it was a very difficult task. So uncertainty is something that I live with every day.
So it doesn't bother you?
Oh, no, it bothers me, because I think, particularly with the presidency, there needs to be some predictability, some confidence that he is going to do the right thing. And in the first 100 days, I'm not sure we're there yet. He's changed his opinions. He wants the wall to be built, but he's not going to get Mexico to pay for it. He was elected because he was non-traditional. I mean, that's what got him elected.
Right.
And now, he has to follow through. If he gets a third of the stuff done, I'll be shocked. You know, and I would say that about any presidency, not just Donald Trump.
Tom, thank you. We're going to move on now to the second block of the evening. And the question on the table is, if Donald Trump is taking a different approach to wielding the powers of the presidency, is that because that's what his voters were asking for? We're going to turn to both Max and Randy one more time here. When it comes to wielding power, one thing President Obama brought attention to in his closing days, as President Trump has in his first 100, is the executive order. Max, who was the first president to use it? And, you know, was this something specifically laid out in the Constitution of this country?
The Constitution does provide for executive orders, but you have to infer it. In Article 2, it says the executive power will be exercised by a president of the United States. It doesn't define the executive power. In Article 1, the legislative power is very specifically defined. But executives recognize that in order to function satisfactorily as an executive, you have to have the power to issue orders and issue
right.
executive orders. Also, he has the power to take care that the laws be faithfully executed and this kind of thing. So, again, you have to infer it. But who was the first president? It's probably no surprise it was George Washington.
Really?
In fact, every president has issued executive orders except one, William Henry Harrison, who died a month after he was inaugurated. He
Is
didn't have
right?
time to issue an executive order.
Let's give Max Skidmore a round of applause for being so full of facts this evening. That's pretty good. Randy, a question for you. I think many of us are aware of President Truman's use of the executive order to desegregate the military. but maybe not as many are aware of how we used it against the steel industry back in 1952. Give us a brief history of what happened there.
Well, we were engaged in the Korean War. President Truman had issued a proclamation declaring a national emergency. The steel unions wanted more pay. The steel companies were resisting this. They wanted to be able to raise their prices. Basically, the negotiations came to a head. A strike was imminent. President Truman did not feel that he could allow, as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, the interruption of the production of steel in a time of national emergency. It was crucial to the armed forces to keep the steel on the way. So in April of 1952, he issued an executive order essentially nationalizing the steel industry. He seized the major steel companies, put them under the control of the Secretary of Commerce. They were still administered by the workers still worked there, the company administrators still worked there, but the Secretary of Commerce was overseeing everything.
Can you imagine that happening today?
Quite a step. No. Truman was immediately challenged in court by the steel companies. They sued. The case very quickly went to the U.S. Supreme Court. I guess it was June of 1952. The U.S. Supreme Court declared in the Youngstown Tube and Steel case that President Truman had exceeded his authority. He did not have the constitutional authority to seize private property under those circumstances. Truman had acted on the supposition that he possessed the inherent powers as president under the Constitution, as commander-in-chief in a time of national emergency, to do this. The Supreme Court said that he did not have those inherent powers, and Truman had not acted on the basis of any statutory powers granted him by law, by Congress. He said, I don't need that. I'm the president. This is a time of national emergency. I can do this. The Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, much to Mr. Truman's displeasure, said, no, you can't do that. And Truman handed the steel companies back to private hands.
Yeah, Franklin Roosevelt did the same thing with North American Aviation, and he got away with it. The reason Harry Truman's executive order was struck down is that he ignored the Taft-Hartley Act, which the court said governed. The Taft-Hartley Act had not been passed when Franklin Roosevelt issued his executive order. So Truman was ignoring a law that did exist.
All right. Just want to remind you all out in Facebook Live land who may be watching and listening, we really need some tweets. We'd love to hear from you. Hashtag a nation engaged, no spaces. Karen Spaulding, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So the question again, if President Truman is wielding powers differently, is that because that's what the voters asked for? What do you think?
I believe it is. I think that Donald Trump did not care what the media thought. He doesn't care what anybody thinks, as we all know from his tweets, which are kind of, in my opinion, sometimes not presidential and not diplomatic. But I think his voters wanted that. I think we're tired of diplomacy to the point where it's so wishy-washy that we don't have anybody making a strong voice for what we believe in. And it's been many, many years since we heard a candidate stand up strong and not be concerned about this issue or that issue to the point where we did not even know where he stood. And when Donald Trump came to the getting ready for the presidency, he was strong and he said these things and we said, wow, someone is finally voicing what we are feeling. And even if it was rude, even if he did have some checkered past, we didn't care about the past. We only cared for what was happening at that time and what he had to say. And we all know that there is a drug problem from Mexico. We know that there's trafficking from Mexico. And the media, to me, turned that whole Mexican thing into a race issue when it is far greater than that. And he knows that, and a lot of us, if we took time to think about it, we would know that too. And a lot of what he does in the presidential capacity, he is doing overwhelmingly because he knows and has researched what needs to be done. And he doesn't tell us all what it is because he doesn't want to have people come against what he is trying to work.
But it's his strength that drew you in.
It is his strength. And because he was a businessman. And I remember when Obama came into office, 8 years ago, and the nation was in a financial crisis similar to what we're going to face here in the near future. And at that time, you know, he had to wield some presidential, I mean, in fact, I thought, really, is he going after the private businesses and telling them to fire CEOs and all the kind of things that he did? But he saw the nation in crisis, and so he used his presidential powers to help the country come together.
I'm just curious, do you regard President Obama as a strong president?
No, but I don't view him as a weak president. I do think that he changed many of his values and views from what he came into office 8 years ago, or you know, when he first started office, and then he changed a lot of things. And really, I was disappointed because I thought that he would be stronger and not let other people's ideas and views mold his views. And that's one thing about Trump, and I think that the voters thought that, is the man is not going to care what other people think. He's going to stick with what he thinks is right. And I think that was his strength. So yeah, I think the voters thought that he was going to be that kind of a guy.
Karen Spaulding, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
We have a comment on social media here.
Yeah.
Randy, let's throw this to you. How are Harry Truman and Donald Trump alike or different with regards to their willingness to learn on the job and seek wise counsel? Great question.
Well, I think Truman was willing to do that and was open-minded about seeking wise counsel. He did not have much of an ego, really, when he came into the presidency, because he knew that he had a lot to learn. And he was willing to appoint Jimmy Burns as Secretary of State, a man who had been had wanted really to be president, and was very disappointed that he hadn't been chosen as vice presidential nominee in 1944. But Truman felt that he needed Burns in that position, so he appointed him. He appointed strong men to positions of, like Secretary of State after Burns, George C. Marshall, whom Truman greatly admired, Dean Acheson. He was willing to seek the advice of people who had considerable experience in government, and it was an on-the-job learning process.
So bring us up to 2017, compare and contrast.
I can't say as an outsider. Donald Trump seems to have much more self-assurance coming into the presidency than Truman did. Of course, he was not thrust into the job in the way that Truman was. He had actively campaigned for the office. I would say the impression that I have of Trump is not lack of confidence. It's kind of overweening confidence, super confidence, that he can come in and make major changes.
Overconfidence.
Maybe not overconfidence, but certainly not feeling the need to rely on others for advice. Now, obviously, as president, eventually you do have to rely on others for advice, and I think that he is coming to grips with that, as every president does. His background a little different, not a senator, not a member of the House of Representatives, not a governor. There haven't been too many presidents we've had who didn't hold any of those offices.
You know, Harry Truman famously said when he became president, he turned to the press corps and he said, boys, he said something like, I feel like the moon and the stars and the sky have all fallen on my shoulders. You certainly can't imagine Donald Trump saying anything remotely like that.
Hi, my name is Christine Grossman and I'm a musician. And I, since the question of the press and the bias in the press was brought up, I was hoping to wanted to ask a question to you all and the audience, which is, since Trump has sort of pushed the press in uncharted territory, if President Trump says something and if the press, if a reporter can refute his statement with facts, and in their reporting, they report what he said, and then they report things that are proving his statements to be false with facts. Is that bias? Is that biased? Should they just report what he says? So where does it go into biased territory is my question.
Is that a question for us? can we take a question? We can. I got that impression. If anyone else wants to handle that.
Or to the audience.
Mr. Big NPR man, feel free.
Well, there's a lot of fact-checking with this presidency, and I cover immigration typically out of the Southwest, and so what is said and the set of facts that we hear from the White House on which policy is based, and then what you can actually truth squad in the ground are sometimes different things, and we will continue to report factually. As we say at NPR, we stand with the facts, and we let you all decide, and we're going to do that every day.
I'm Deborah Parmet. I've been a math tutor, and I do a lot of volunteer work. I want to talk to that because I think it's very important for us to have the correct facts, and as the other gentleman said, to make our own minds up, but I think we need to have the true facts. And my feeling is President Trump does not want us to have the true facts in many areas, and he falsely accuses the press all the time and calls it fake news. So I think it is very important that the press come out and give us the true facts. And then I think opinions from the press are important if they're labeled opinions. Editorials can be very enlightening. I think they can be very thought-provoking, I think. But if we cannot rely on facts, then how do you make any decisions? If 1 + 1 = 2, what do you do? I mean, if the climate change, all the many, many complicated issues before us, if we cannot rely on facts, well, let's write a fairy tale.
Yes, sir.
I'm Dan Hall, and
Hi, Dan.
I'm in agricultural management, my field. And I'd like to address the question on the board, which is Donald Trump taking a different approach to the presidency because of his voters? I would say absolutely yes. I would remind the audience, though, that a president can only, under Schedule C appointments, affect about 5% of the federal workforce. So I look upon the federal government and the president as sort of the helmsman of the ship, trying to turn it a little bit a different direction than it had been going, but 95% of the federal employees are still there, and they're still pushing the ship along with its momentum the same direction. But I do think that voters were interested in jobs, the economy. They saw a businessman that could make a change and bring jobs to this country. The coal miners were out of work. He wanted to put them back to work, and is doing so, and has met with some of the major corporations in this company and encouraged them to bring jobs back to America. And I think this is exactly what the 40% or more of the people in this country voted for, and I think he's doing exactly what we wanted.
So you think he's off to a good start in that regard?
In that regard, yes. But he's had lots of problems with his own Congress, his own party, and with the other party. Many of the federal appointments haven't been made because they haven't been taken up yet.
Dan, thank you. Quick question for Randy Soule. Has history come down on the question of whether or not Harry Truman was a good president? As historians are, looking forward to critiquing Donald Trump in a few more years.
Mm-hmm. Well, the most recent C-SPAN poll of historians and political scientists ranked Truman as the 6th greatest president in American history. I suppose that most American historians regard him as a successful president, even a great or near great president. That doesn't mean all historians agree with that verdict, but you won't find all historians agreeing on anything.
But when he left office, he was unpopular.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Oh, the Korean War was unpopular. The McCarthyism was rampant at that time. The Democrats had controlled the presidency for 20 years. People were ready for a change. And some of Truman's eccentricities had alarmed people. His threatening to punch out a music critic who criticized his daughter Margaret's singing performance, his unconventional shirts that he wore down in Key West, the Hawaiian shirts. Some people didn't think that was suitable for a president to be saying and doing and behaving in such ways. Just a combination of things, I would say. Mostly
distaste for the Korean War and this very unpopular war. People forget about how unpopular the Korean War was.
Right.
It was a deadlock like Vietnam, and Truman bore the brunt of that.
Let's move on to block number three, John.
Good. Okay. We've asked you, what do you think about President Trump in the tradition of the presidency? What's behind his approach to the power of the office? We're going to ask you to make, well, we've been having lots of strong opinions, so let's keep going in that vein. Is the Trump presidential style good for the presidency? Is it good for American democracy? I would like to ask Reverend Vernon Howard to please come up to the microphone. Reverend Howe, your thoughts on the Trump presidency here at coming up on 100 days.
It is my sense that the question deals with issues of values, issues of ethos, of the cultural and social fiber, the intangibles that a candidate and president can bring to the table. That's how I kind of discern the question. Is it good for a candidate and or president to, in fact, state that he could stand in the middle of the streets of New York and murder an American citizen, and that his supporters would still vote for him? Is it good for a candidate or a president to mock persons with disabilities openly and publicly? Is it good for a candidate or a president to birth a birthers movement, false accusations of the first two-term African-American president, and then after 8 years have to halfway apologize for such statements and activity that is laced with such racism and falsehoods? Is it good for a candidate or American president to make statements of vulgarisms about women and what one believes might be appropriate with such obscenity and degradation of women, our daughters, our mothers, our grandmothers? If these things are good, persons will have to judge that. Hmm. With respect to, I don't think they are. Hmm. With respect to policy, two things that the president said, did, ran on, and I heard it today as a matter of reference to the president's strength. The president said Mexico was going to pay for the wall that we built. The president said China was going to stop its currency exploitation, manipulation, and its unfair trade balances. In order to put America back to work again as a populist movement president. And yet, it appears to me, the president came back from both engagements with those leaders with nothing to say, no policy change to report, except that they were good meetings, but that now looking for other avenues, such as the American people, to pay for the wall, and nothing on China's exploitation of the U.S. worker and the U.S. economy. So the goodness that this president brings to us, both tangible and intangible, from my perspective, is questionable at least, and not present at all at the most.
But Reverend Howard, we're hearing and we're seeing a somewhat different man than the one who campaigned now. In these first 100 days, as you noted, he has walked back on some of these statements that he said that he was going to knock it out of the park when he came into the White House, and he was going to, you know, call China a currency manipulator. He was going to get Mexico to pay for the wall, and he was suspicious of NATO. You know, many things he's been learning on the job, a rather steep learning curve. Do you think that are you heartened at all that that he is learning, that he is becoming a different man than you saw in the campaign and could go on to be a good president?
I see no difference in his purported agendas. I think he's given effort what he has found is failure, whether it is ACA, whether it is building the wall, whether it is calling China to be more sensitive and fair with us. I don't see a different man. I see a man who has discovered that, well, just like he discovered with healthcare, I never knew it could be so hard. I think he has discovered that the presidency is easy to criticize from the outside, but harder to manage from the inside.
Trump's presidential style is a question on the table. Reverend Howard, thank you very much. Please come on up to join the conversation. Tweet us, hashtag A Nation Engaged. Yes, ma'am. Bridget.
Hello, my name's Bridget McCandless. You asked my profession. I work in philanthropy. One of the things that is critical in the world of advocacy is having an engaged electorate. I would say that one of the things that Trump's style has done is to undermine people's belief in the voting system, in making a mockery of what is what I consider people's most important responsibility in being a civic citizen, which is being a thoughtful and engaged voter. By undermining that, I think that's just terrible for American democracy. And I hope that you are seeing actually perhaps the other side of that, with people becoming more engaged and giving more voice to what kind of America that they choose to live in, and by bringing the concerns of a very broad base of people to bear when we develop policy and think about the agenda.
He undermined the voting system. Help me with that.
By making false claims that millions of people were voting who were not eligible to vote, it makes people question the validity of their local elections, their state elections, and their presidential elections.
Thank you, Bridget. Yes, sir.
My name is Mark Anthony Jones, and I co-own three businesses, and I'm chairman of the Jackson County Republican Committee. So I look at your hashtag, and as I listen to the last two people speak, I thought one letter change in that hashtag is actually what happened in this last election. It could be called A Nation Enraged, because that's what really happened. Donald Trump spoke to the angry America who are tired of deficit, debt, overspending, irresponsibility, just a lot of things. And of course, I just, you know, I listen to, you know, I listen to a lot of disagreement on my committee. And I don't really care that we disagree. I think it's a good thing that we disagree. I think if you have disagreement among a committee, you actually can work together because you have different thoughts. No, we don't all have to agree on everything, but you do have to elect a leader, and one was elected. And it seemed like it only enraged more than it actually helped. And so currently you have a completely divided America. And I don't see that really getting any better when you have facts thrown around as if they're facts when they're really not facts. We don't agree on the facts. I don't agree with most of what this gentleman said, even though I think he's probably a wonderful man. I don't have to agree. I think we have to figure out how we disagree and yet work together toward bettering our country. And I think being thoughtful about not enraging your opponent would be a good thing.
Is President Trump's style in office going to show us a path forward when it comes to learning how to disagree respectably?
I think that's exactly what you've saw. When you want to point out that he's said Mexico is going to pay for the wall and then he backs off of that, you do have to back off of some things, because sometimes you learn that you don't have all the facts, and sometimes you learn more things than, I mean, you have a different perspective once you learn more facts. And so I think some of us could take a little bit of a lesson from that and learn a few more facts instead of going off half-cocked and listing out a whole bunch of things that enrage your opponent. That seems to be a better way to do this, to try to work together and find something that is common ground so that you can accomplish a few things along the way. I agree with Dan, or I think it was Dave, who said if he accomplishes the third, and the gentleman over here said he would be surprised if he accomplished a third. I look for at least a third of these things to be accomplished because there's a bit of tenacity that goes along with the presidency. And I think Trump has the personality and style to have the tenacity to outlast his opponents on some of these issues. Not every single one of them. But I wish we could stop poking each other in the eye, so to speak, and try to work together.
Mark Anthony Jones, thank you very much. Ma'am?
I wanted to comment on the question, is President Trump's style good for the presidency? Is it good for American democracy? I feel that there is a myth of the American businessman as a leader. I think they are completely different things. People who run corporations particularly are legally required to act really only with the best interest of the shareholders at stake, having nothing to do with the welfare of the workers. It's a completely different responsibility. You cannot run a government, a well-functioning government, with those, a government is not a business. Everyone has to be accounted for. You can't just discard people, and move on and say, we're gonna profit. Government is not a business. It is in my best interest to make sure we're all taken care of, because I don't wanna walk down the street and be mugged. It's in my best interest to make sure that people get mental health care, people get, medical care, so I don't get tuberculosis if I'm riding on the subway. This is things that businesses don't have a responsibility for. So and President Trump himself in the recent AP article acknowledged, I just learned, when you're in business, you don't have to have heart. Gosh, when you're in this now, I gotta consider heart. It's like, yeah, you do. It's not a business. It shouldn't be a business.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Good evening.
My name is Mark Duke, and I practice employment law. And on the question whether President Trump's style is good for the presidency or good for democracy, no, I don't think so. Not good for the presidency or for democracy or for humanity in general.
Because?
And for two reasons. One having to do with confidence, and one having to do with truth-telling. I mean, there was a mention earlier of confidence, the confidence he expresses. I think it's extremely important for us to have a confident leader, but I don't think he is. I think he's blustery. But I think the confidence that he expresses is really more of a mask for rampant insecurity. The tweets about the size of the crowd at the inauguration, and about the continued tweets about his Electoral College victory. He wants people to like him, and that clouds, I think, everything he does. And as far as truth-telling, I think people will say, well, all politicians hide the truth or lie. I think politicians and lawyers, being around lawyers all the time, will shade the truth in a certain way, but that's not what he does.
Thank you. I hold in my hands the final question of the evening, the final block of the evening. The question on the table is, how much power should any president have? Questions to help frame this conversation. First, should extraordinary circumstances ever justify a president stepping on the generally understood powers of the office like Truman did when he took control of the steel mills, as we heard about earlier tonight? Question two, if circumstances suggest additional powers are needed by the president, how should those powers be bestowed? And thirdly, has the system worked, and should we just leave well enough alone? Ponder that for a moment, and then if you have some thoughts on it, head for the microphones. Again, you can tweet us at A Nation Engaged. As you're thinking of your answers, we'll turn to Max Skidmore for a final time. Max, you say a president can approach the power of the office like Teddy Roosevelt or William Howard Taft. Would you briefly explain those two very different views of the office?
Yes, these are the two polar opposites of presidential responsibility and authority. President Theodore Roosevelt advocated what he called the stewardship theory, and he set it forth in a very articulate manner. He said the President of the United States has not only the power but the duty to do anything that the good of the public requires, provided that the Constitution does not forbid it, nor the laws. Now, recognize that that does give due consideration to the laws and to the Constitution. It's not like a president who would assert, I have the right to arrest anyone I think is dangerous and hold that person without counsel, without habeas corpus, without recourse to the courts or to laws. It did pay attention to the Constitution, to the laws. William Howard Taft, on the other hand, said that's a dangerously activist view of the presidency. The president should do only what the Constitution specifies specifically that he do or that Congress directs him to do.
Just that simple. All right. Yes, sir. Your name and what you do.
My name's Kirk Doan. I'm a business lawyer with one of the large firms here in Kansas City. And I guess my comment comes from two statements that Max made. One was that the legislative powers are pretty well defined in the Constitution and the executive powers are not. And I think that's going to be a contest for the ages as long as we are a society, that we're going to have a back and forth over what powers the president has, what are reserved to the legislature, and which ones are to the judicial. The other thing I would like to comment on is your statement that laws need to be faithfully executed. I think the framers realized that some of the executives weren't going to find laws to their tastes, and that was an admonition to try to, you know, enforce the laws as written. And again, there were some laws that were going to be unpopular to the executive, but he still had a duty to enforce them.
Do you think the president has overstepped his authority to date?
Well, I mean, Woodrow Wilson said, the president's as big a man as he's going to make it. And I think that's what the modern trend has been, that the executive's going to push the power as far as they can, and we push back with things like the War Powers Act, and you have that balance, and the pendulum goes back and forth.
Okay. Kurt, thank you very much. Ma'am, come on forward.
I just want to say one thing, and that we
remind us who you are again.
Oh, yeah. Karen Spaulding.
Yeah, Karen.
And I just want to say one thing. He's not the dictator. You know, we have checks and balances for a reason. And all through the candidacy and all through before they were elected with Hillary and Trump, and they would go back and forth, people would like say, be upset over this candidate or that candidate. I'm like, they're not the dictator. You know, they have a platform. GOP had a platform. The Democratic people had a platform. And if you don't like their platform, you don't vote for that candidate. And they're not the dictator. And Donald Trump, he has as much power as Congress and the judicial system are going to allow him to have, and the Constitution as well as the Constitution. So that's what I am counting on in our, where we're concerned about what Trump's going to do and the things that he's going to do. We have checks and balances in place, and we need to use them. And that's why we're here tonight, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Karen, thanks again. Yeah. Max, do you want to give us a rundown of the three or four presidents who stretched their presidential authority the most? Is there some consensus on this?
Well, most notably, Abraham Lincoln did in the wartime emergency, and he did it for certainly a good cause. Woodrow Wilson is known for having stretched. Franklin Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, he is the one who asserted the right to arrest anyone if he thought this person presented a threat. I was amazed that there wasn't a popular outcry at that, and hold them indefinitely. The system slowly worked and moved to help counter that. But yes, we've had presidents who have done that. But with regard to facts and information, we live in a democracy, and the people ultimately have control over government, but they can't control it adequately and effectively and to good ends if they don't understand what really is the case of a situation, what the facts are. And as the late Will Rogers once said, it ain't what people don't know that's so dangerous, it's what people know that just ain't so. And we've heard constantly all the horrible things that exist,
yeah,
and that are going to be set right. But how many of these things really do exist in the way that the fevered imagination of some spokesmen indicate that they are?
I want one more quick follow-up, and that is, we talked briefly in the green room about the imperial presidency, this concept that Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote a book about in 1973, starting with the Nixon presidency, when he said, when the president does it, that means it's legal. And so a lot of commentators have said that the imperial presidency has been marching forward. It certainly got momentum with 9/11 when presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama started expanding the national security state surveillance. And I think with the way Trump swaggered as a candidate, there was thinking that he would come in as emperor, that he would further the imperial presidency. Do you think he is?
I don't think so, because Mr. Trump has a great deal of learning to do. He doesn't understand the workings. I don't mean this to be inflammatory, but he really is learning of what the job is and what it entails. Other people who have come in understood. When he came in, he was amazed that he had to hire people in the office. He assumed that all the people who were there when President Obama left would still be there to run things. And we've had a comment that many of the more important positions in the government, vast numbers of them, simply aren't filled. And it isn't because they haven't been confirmed, it's because they haven't been nominated, they haven't been chosen. Mr. Trump really is not moving to govern in the way that other presidents have. His signal accomplishment was to have been repeal of Obamacare immediately. His party controls the presidency and controls both houses of Congress, and they all agreed it should be done, but not on how to do it.
Yes, sir.
My name is Sean Hanna. I'm a property investor, and I work in construction. So my comment about the power of the presidency, I feel like I'm one of the few people that I know that wasn't surprised that Trump was elected, despite the polls and things like that. And it's not because I believe that the polls were rigged. It's because I knew of so many people who were lying about who they would vote for. So many people who would definitely, certainly, were ready to vote for Trump. But because of just the social stigma and the social pressure that's been created, that partly being this idea that if you accept some things about a candidate, you must accept all of the things that come with the candidate and that you're responsible for them. And then also just to not be sort of punished socially or to be disrespectful to those who would disagree and would say, you know, essentially to not create a lot of other social problems for themselves. I was, however, really surprised that so many people were so enraged and so afraid when he was elected. And at first, I mean, that really threw me back that a lot of, you know, kids in my kid's school, the parents were upset that their kids would be deported and all of these things would be happening and nothing was going to be the same. And the reason I wasn't afraid of those things is because I trust in the power of our Constitution and I know the limited powers of our mm-hmm. president. And so I feel like it's a big conversation, but a lot of the conversation that where this conversation is taking place, and this is kind of the last thing I'll say here, is that if you expect that the president is going to do a lot of things, and that the government is going to do a lot of things, someone mentioned that they need their government to keep them from being mugged, they need their government to provide for every health issue that they have, they need their government to do all of these things, then I can understand how you would also, wanting them to have so much power, would be afraid when someone that you disagree with gets into power. I think I would remind us that we can't really have both. You can't have a government that does all of these powerful things for you that can, on a whim, even in national emergency, work unchecked by the Supreme Court or pass health care and solve all of these problems, and also have a limited power that they can't do a lot of bad things as well, or that the next president can't come in and do a lot of bad things. And so that's kind of my perspective.
Sean, thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
You've just heard A Nation Engaged, Power and the Presidency, with NPR's John Burnett and KCUR's Steve Kraske, along with Truman Library archivist Randy Soule and UMKC political science professor Max Skidmore. This event was held Tuesday, April 25th at the Truman Presidential Museum in Independence, Missouri. Thanks to KCUR for their help with today's program. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.